Welcome to ASAP Nowcast, highlighting the very best content from this month's issue of ASAP Now, the magazine of the American College of Emergency Physicians and the official voice of emergency medicine. I'm your host, ASAP Now Medical Editor-in-Chief, Jeremy Faust. Hello, welcome back to ASAP Nowcast. I am psyched about this month's episode, mainly because I think that the day that the vaccine efficacy data came out, Pfizer and then Moderna about a week later, probably one of the greatest feelings I've had during this whole pandemic. Just to know that there was actually something that had a real chance to change the face of this pandemic that was coming down the pipeline. And so I literally got like chills when I read, not like fever and chills, like good chills, warm and fuzzy feeling, reading the early reports on this stuff. And what was so amazing was that we had decided to cover the overview of vaccines already before this data came out. So we kind of planned this in October, and then November that great news came. So Josh Niforatis in the Brief 19 space was covering this for us and really just walking through the vaccine development process, because as emergency physicians, this may not be the kind of thing we think about too often. So first of all, think about what kind of antigen would you want. We all, of course, know that they decided to go after this spike protein in the SARS-CoV-2 virus, and that seems to have worked well. And then you get to the phases. The phase one clinical trial is really a safety phase to see if anyone has any bad reactions. And phase two traditionally is looking for a better idea of what dose to give people, and you get some idea about whether it's working. And then phase three is where you find out efficacy. Is this thing actually working? And we all, of course, know that usually it takes so much time to get that information, because it's unusual to have a disease that is so prevalent that we can get information between a placebo and an intervention group so quickly. Unfortunately, this virus is out of control, so we actually got the data quickly. And then, of course, the part that we haven't gotten yet is the phase four, the long-term safety, efficacy, and also effectiveness, which is slightly different than efficacy. Efficacy is really how things perform in the trial environment, and effectiveness is how it goes in the real world. So do people actually take the vaccine? And so does the rollout really match the ideal that we saw in the laboratory environment, so to speak? Although sometimes effectiveness can be better, because again, we don't have to vaccinate every single person, right? We have to vaccinate as many as we can, and there are some who are going to already have been infected. We don't know whether the people who were infected will be immune for as long or as well as the people with the vaccine. People sometimes think that natural immunity would be better. Actually, not the case necessarily, right? We don't know that. So it can sometimes be the case that in the real world, these things do even better because there's some degree of natural immunity out there. Combine that with the immunity of the vaccine, and we're in great shape. So it's really remarkable that we got this far. Most people did not think a vaccine would come in 12 to 18 months time, or they thought that might be what we were dealing with. Turns out we had data within 8, 9, 10 months. Just amazing. So just think about the overview of the vaccine candidates. There's nucleic acid-based ones, which of course the mRNA vaccines have worked out nicely, and they can be developed quickly, right? Because you can sort of create in the laboratory a string of genetic information that will then be translated and transcribed, or actually translated, I should say, by our own cells, ribosomes, biochemistry and molecular bio, so cool. And then there are other ways to get a vaccine made. There's viral vectors, which is basically you use an existing virus to sort of get the information into the cell. A similar idea is that you're actually getting genetic material into your cells. Your cells then make the protein, and we, of course, recognize that protein as foreign and make antibodies. And then there are viral vectors as well, so live attenuated vaccines, or maybe inactivated, mutated viruses that are less likely or unlikely or impossible to cause real disease. So those are the big ones. And then, of course, if you have your protein-based ones, we certainly have some advantages in the sense that they induce a lot of neutralizing antibodies, but they require multiple doses, so a little bit of a balance between all of these things. But I think the real story, of course, has been that the mRNA vaccines, Pfizer and Moderna, worked so well. So that was so exciting to be covering sort of the idea of how a vaccine is made. And then right when we came out with this, we get this huge news about the fact that the first two trials that we got data on had an efficacy of greater than 90%, 94 and 95%. What a cool experience that was. And I think we all are excited about that. But in the meantime, of course, we can't give up too soon. We're going to be treating this disease for quite some time. And one of the things that I wanted to highlight in the magazine, was so excited to get this one, was an article by some of the researchers, Austin Kalaru and Kathleen Lee, sent us a great piece, which we published, about COVID patients sending them home out of the ED. Because we are constantly worried about which patients in any disease, who should we admit to the hospital? Who can we safely send home? This is something that we spend a lot of time thinking about as emergency doctors. And now with COVID-19, there is some data about this to make us really understand what we're dealing with. And so what I thought was fascinating here was that nearly 5% of patients returned to the ED within 72 hours and then needed admission to the hospital. So for context, that rate might be 5 times higher than the described rate for all comers to the ED, meaning we're sending a bunch of COVID patients home and they're much more likely to come back. Well, that's maybe not surprising. We don't necessarily have much to offer the mild patients, so why admit them? But then a subset is going to get worse, and those who identify as having gotten worse, they come back. And that's kind of, in a way, anticipatory guidance in action. An additional 3.5% of patients needed admission within 1 week. So again, the fact that the hospitalizations occurred and the progression was such that it was, that they needed oxygen or other therapeutic medications that became available, doesn't really say that we failed. In fact, I think it says that we have been doing the right thing. At the same time, we do want to know who these patients are. So if you're on the fence about who to send home, you might have an idea about the characteristics that would confer a higher risk for returning to the hospital with COVID-19. And these were not surprising, the things that were found and described in this paper. So age was a risk factor, and the increase there was dramatic. Probably that's the biggest one. So the probability of patients older than 60 returning for admission was 9%, which is more than 3 times the rate of the bounce backs for patients aged 18 to 39. And they also found that patients with any abnormal findings on chest x-ray, like a pneumonia, had double the probability of returning. And of course, patients who had other symptoms, which would not surprise you, but just good to say it out loud, fever or hypoxia, which was defined as a pulse ox of less than 95% on ambient air. And other things that played into the possibility of a higher rate for ED bounce back, obesity, hypertension, and also just kind of middle age, age 41 to 59, also risk factors for returning within 1 week. So basically, it's the people who, when you admit them, you're worried about them having maybe a worse clinical course as inpatients. Some of those same folks crop up as the ones who might have a higher risk of an ED bounce back with a higher rate of subsequently needing that admission to the hospital for the treatments that we now have, which of course are still kind of limited, right? I mean, dexamethasone for your hypoxics, remdesivir for your patients who have hypoxia, and especially the sort of younger middle-aged adults are the ones, the subgroup that seem to have a better outcome in terms of decreasing that length of stay. Still no mortality benefit there, so a little disappointing. But again, there are still things we can offer patients in the hospital. So again, reasonable to send these folks home, but also reasonable to expect that some are going to come back. That's not a failure on our part. That is just anticipatory guidance. Sending home a bunch of patients of whom only a few come back, I think that's good, but we're learning more and more about this. So I think this is not the last that we will hear about this issue. Speaking of kind of thinking about the issue of patients in the ED, we have a great recurring section called benchmarking, and James Augustine, who is one of the great minds of our field, always contributes to this column, and we always get some good data snapshots here. And this is actually pre-COVID ED trends, and I think it's kind of interesting just to see where we're at. So let's look at some graphs here that you'll see in the magazine for November. First of all, just looking in terms of ED visits by patients under the age of 18, steadily coming down that percentage. From 2003, 23%, and really hovering in the low 20% range, 20, 21, 22% from 2004 on to 2012. And then pretty much dropping in 2013 to the 17% range, a little higher for a couple of years, and then down to 16, 17, 15% in 2019. So that's really interesting. Another thing I thought was also interesting is the ED transfer rate. So how often do we transfer patients, and who are the types of facilities who are doing the transferring? And it makes total sense, right? So first of all, in terms of all EDs, the transfer rate is about 3% of patients, okay? And it makes total sense to me that if you look at the different kinds of EDs, pediatric EDs, adult EDs, or large, medium, and small EDs, well, who do you think does the most transferring? And of course, the answer is the small EDs, the places under 20,000 patients per year or 20,000 to 40 patients per year, of course those are the places transferring the most because it implies a resource issue or an issue of not having the right specialty. So a lot of times I think if you're like me and you work at a community site, but then also I also work in a referring facility, a really large urban sort of quaternary care, whatever you want to call it, magnet hospital, people fly in to come get treatment, yada, yada, yada. Yeah, the reason we get so many transfers is resources. And so we look at these transfers and we say, why they transfer that one? And the linearity between the size of the hospital and how likely they are or are not to transfer really tells a story. So if you're going to tell me that if you were working at a place where there was fewer than 20,000 visits a year, that you wouldn't be doing the same amount of transferring, I would say, yeah, I doubt it. Because really, it really comes down to resources and safe management. So it's always good to realize that the person on the other side of that interaction probably is sending you something that has a lot to do with resources and not necessarily because you have some special knowledge or advantage, not trying to turf these patients elsewhere. So I think this data almost do make me really understand the nature of transfers being just a resource thing. All right, and then speaking of dispo and what we do with patients, a couple of quick things here. First, the number of patients who are admitted to the hospital. Really interesting data here from 2004, every year, all the way up to 2019. So in 2004, the admission rate in the ED was 16.3%. And it kind of went up a little bit. I'm watching this graph here. And then really it's stable, though, for really a decade. And then in 2017, 18, 19, starts to really climb, 20, 22%. Just a huge climb from 2017 to 2019. And I kind of wonder what that's about. It's been a steady climb, really, since 2014. But it really the biggest leaps for the past 3 years. And I'm wondering, and this is pre-COVID, of course, 2019. I'm wondering if some of this is increasing observation medicine, because these data do include both patients admitted to inpatient medicine or other services and also observation units, whether they're run by medicine teams or ED teams, doesn't matter. So I think as observation medicine has become more common, with the reimbursement being a little more favorable, then I think that's what's driving some of this. But also our patients are probably just a bit sicker. Who knows? That's a big part of it as well. And then the last graph that we had here was about ED boarding time. And basically the big story is that it had gone up, a ton in 2018 from an average of 120 minutes in 2016, 117 minutes in 2017, burst up to 133 minutes in 2018, and then fell down to 118 in 2019. Don't know exactly the explanation for that, but it's obviously a really big deal when you think about it. Now, okay, so you're going to say, what's the difference, 15 minutes boarding? But as you know, these are medians or means, and so it's a huge, huge deal when it goes up, when it went up like that in 2018. And so the question is, what can be done about that? And one thing that some of you may realize is that the federal government has a program called Hospital Compare. Medicare and Medicaid Services runs this. And since 2013, the hospitals have actually been required to post their results on this, or the CMS reports for us, or for them, what the averages are. So the idea here is a little bit of, it's kind of public shaming. Like if your hospital has to show how it's doing, maybe that'll motivate change. And so the fact that it went up so high in 2018 might have been a blemish there. It's like, oh gosh, what happened? We really need to turn this around. And so, yeah, it's great that it came down back to 118 minutes after that one bad year, but we're still kind of where it started. So the question is why? And I think we've covered in the magazine before that ED boarding is very infrequently a problem that EDs create. It's much more frequently a downstream problem. There's not enough inpatient beds because discharges are slowed because if it's a weekend or something like that. So it's really one of those things where it's sad that we are the ones sort of being looked at. And of course, there are things we can do to help. But for the most part, every study I've seen shows that EDs can help reduce this, but that we're not the drivers behind these long boarding times, and that the best thing we can do is to work with our upstairs partners in helping them see the problem and making this not a ED problem, even though it's in the ED, but making it a hospital problem. And I think that's where we're going to be headed in the future. Now let's head over to the Kids Corner for the November issue of ASAP Now, always popular, and especially this topic, I think, is really one of those things that a lot of us wonder about, are we doing it right, and that is strep pharyngitis, group A strep pharyngitis for kids. And I think the two biggest questions when it comes to treatment comes down to, of course, steroids and antibiotics. What are we doing these days? I personally love to be given some steroids for strep, especially to the kids where I think the data is better for that. And so it was nice to get a little bit of information, or actually a lot of information, based on some randomized controlled trials that have been in the literature for a while, but I had not caught up on. And that's what we do great work on here in the magazine. And you can read the article, because I think you should, because there was a systemic review that they covered and some other trials. And really the conclusion here is that in children who are group A strep positive by the rapid strep test, that's the group you're looking at. These are the group A strep positives by the rapid test. A single dose of oral dexamethasone dosed at 0.6 milligrams per kilogram with a max dose of 10 milligrams does appear to shorten initial onset of pain relief by approximately 6 hours, but does not appear to shorten the time to complete relief of pain. But I like that because people love to know when they're getting better. Boy, can they handle things when they feel a little bit better, coming in from the cold, so to speak. So I love that we have some evidence behind us on that one. And then the second question, antibiotics for strep, for group A strep pharyngitis in the kids. And this data really comes from the 1980s, which I had not read in a while, or maybe ever, and looks at the question that we all, I think, want to know about symptoms and recurrence and that kind of thing. And so Nelson et al., they had actually just 35 patients, just 35 kids, age 5 to 11, with confirmed group A strep by culture and penicillin versus placebo follow-up visits at 48 hours. And the kids with penicillin just had a shorter duration of fever at follow-up, with 28% of placebo patients having persistent fever more than 48 hours, but no treated patients having that with the antibiotics. So that really makes a big difference there. And also a shortened duration of fever at 48 hours in another randomized controlled trial. And this was by Pichicero et al. I love this one because the second author is Dr. Disney. Literally, it's like, hey kids, let's go see Dr. Disney. Let's see if they fall for that one. But in there, they also saw the duration of fever was lower as well with the antibiotics. A meta-analysis by Spinks et al. Looked at a couple of other things like complications, looking at otitis media, a lot less likely with antibiotics, with a rate of incidence of 0.3 with really good confidence intervals there out of 11 studies. And also just thinking about the secondary complications we really worry about, things like peritonsillar abscess or retropharyngeal abscess within 2 months, a lot lower with the group A strep antibiotic treatment group, 0.15. That's a real big difference compared to one, right, in 8 studies. But again, these are all very low risk things, so it's a small number of a small number. But I also thought it was interesting, this is the one we always think about, is the acute rheumatic fever, where the antibiotic group actually had a lower incidence of that. 0.27 was the relative incidence, the risk ratio, I should say, and with good confidence intervals out of 14 studies. And the thing here is, though, that we always think, well, acute rheumatic fever is pretty rare in Western countries. Fewer than 1 in 100,000 kids would get this, compared to maybe 50 out of 100,000 kids in other areas. So there's risk of anaphylaxis from penicillin and other complications, so why would you do that? Interestingly enough, though, the risk of rheumatic disease is a little higher in Western countries than it used to be. It's kind of popped back up, possibly up to 23 to 27 per 100,000. So suggesting that we do see this complication sometimes, and that the antibiotics might play some role. We'll also throw in a little bit of information, though, that they didn't cover in this article, but I couldn't help being me and looking into it just a tiny bit. And it looks like actually, early treatment with antibiotics has this benefit that we talked about, but it also does seem to have a downside, which is a lot of these patients ended up with recurrent strep infections later on. So it's almost like giving the body a chance to fight a little bit actually helps. So maybe the rapid strep being negative or rapid strep being positive, you might want to wait for that culture in some cases in the kids, because if it ends up being a false negative, fine, the culture will grow it out and you could prescribe the kids and they have a day or two without antibiotics and they'll do fine and maybe have fewer complications down the road. So there's some discussion to be had here about that as well. So all to say that we have old evidence, but relatively decent evidence about antibiotics for sore throat with that Cochrane review in 2013, it does make me think about what I would do. I'm not sure if I would always give it because of this or never give it because of this, but certainly this adds to our considerations. And of course, this all just scrapes the surface of the articles we've covered, and there's also some more as well in the ASAP Now for November. Love this article about the GI cocktail, treating that for abdominal pain, Skeptic's Guide to EM. So many other things, news from the college. Check us out online. If you, for some reason, are hearing this and have not gotten your ASAP membership up to date, the magazine is a huge benefit of that. So I always encourage people to remember that this all takes a lot of work and money, and we love the support. So thanks so much for listening, and we will continue to cover the issues that matter to you. One way you can help me know that is to reach out to me at my email, which is jfaust@asap.org. And we just love to hear the ideas, whether it's an article you want to write, something you want to cover, something we did great, something we screwed up. It's all good. We're here to make this all better so that we can have a better improving practice environment for ourselves and our patients and our communities. All right. Thank you so much, and see you next time. ASAP Now is published by Wiley and is a product of the American College of Emergency Physicians. The views expressed on ASAP Nowcast are those of the host and any guests. Our music is provided by Caroline Shaw and So Percussion. Thanks for listening.